Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Buzzkillers, Buzzkillers, is the professor once again. You know, so many history myths can be solved in one episode of a half an hour, an hour, even some of our mini myths that we've been doing. But so many things are so big and so world-changing that they require several episodes. You've already heard over the last couple of months us do a couple episodes on Hitler's early life and his rise to power. But we hadn't even gotten to World War II, which was, of course, where all these things hit the fan. So here we are again with Professor Phil Nash from Penn State University to help us get through all the myths that crop up during what is arguably the worst thing that ever happened, certainly the worst war that ever happened. But it's great to have you here, even though we have to talk about these unpleasant things. How are you, Professor?
Doing great. Always delighted to be here.
Yes. And of course, we're going to show or we're going to examine how all these kind of myths and impressions that Hitler created and all these kind of things all kind of play out when they have to turn into military action on the ground.
That's right.
So let's just recap a little bit about what's happened in 1939, as the war is sort of being ginned up through Munich and other Munich and other agreements.
Right. Well, actually, something we didn't talk about is what is Hitler's beef with Poland.
Yeah. And right. Oh, yeah.
You know, people should remember that. First of all, Poland didn't exist between the 1790s and 1919. Mm-hmm. It had been made to disappear by its neighbors, Prussia, Austria, and Russia. Mm-hmm. And you know, the geographic core of Poland was part of the Russian Empire that sort of jutted into Central Europe through World War I. At the end of World War I at Versailles, basically Poland is resurrected. And it was a pretty big country, and it was created in the center of Europe. And it's given a stretch of land known as the Polish Corridor across German territory so that Poland has access to the Baltic Sea.
Right.
It's where the free city of Danzig or Gdansk is, mm-hmm. and it cuts the German province of East Prussia off from the rest of Germany.
Right.
And German nationalists like Hitler just go nuts at this. They just can't abide the idea that German territory has been given to Poland and that Germany's been cut in two.
Even though that's right. The cut in two part is.
Right.
It's as if someone took over the Mississippi River, a foreign country, and was able to
Exactly. All the way to the Canadian border.
Right.
Exactly. It's a similar thing. It really rankles the German nationalists. And, you know, you've got a lot of places in Western Poland, which was 1914 German territory.
Right.
It's overwhelmingly occupied by ethnic Germans. So Poland is Hitler's obvious next target. Mm-hmm. After he conquers Czechoslovakia in late 1938 and early 1939. And he starts doing the same thing he had done before with Czechoslovakia. He starts rattling the saber. He starts big propaganda campaign about how ethnic Germans are being victimized by the evil Poles, about how this is German territory and it belongs to Germany, we're going to go to war, et cetera. What has changed is that the British and the French, really the only powers in a position to stop Hitler, they've ended their appeasement policy.
Right.
They understand finally what they're dealing with, that Hitler's not just about reunifying ethnic Germans, but that he's an expansionist who continually lies about his goals. Mm-hmm. And so they, end of March, early April 1939, the Western allies, British and French, they extend a military guarantee to the Poles, which is to say, if Germany attacks, you will attack Germany.
Right.
So the stage has now been set for World War II, even though at first it only involves four countries and their empires.
That's true. I never think about that. It is only four countries at the beginning.
Yeah, at the beginning. Eventually, so, I mean, of course, by the way, you can argue that World War One starts in World War II starts in the 1930s with the Japanese.
When they invade Man,
right? Or even Manchuria in 1931. But it's kind of hard to call it a world war after September 1939. In any case, it's certainly going to become one. What the one piece that's not in place for Hitler at first is, what about the Soviet Union?
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, the Soviet Union ruled by, as I like to say, the Hitler's main competitor for title of scumbag of the 20th century. It's run by Joseph Stalin,
who
actually killed more people than Hitler did, except for obviously starting the war. huge, mysterious, totalitarian dictatorship, super huge country, which is in a position to have something to say if Hitler invades Poland, because it's on the other side of Poland.
Sure, and Poland may be seen as a buffer
for
Russia.
Right, exactly. So in other words, Hitler doesn't, in the summer of 1939, Hitler doesn't worry about the British and French. Maybe he should have, but he doesn't. He worries about the Soviets. That's all solved in the end of August 1939 when he concludes the Nazi-Soviet pact.
Right.
Where the Soviets and the Nazis essentially agree, despite the fact that they are ideological polar opposites.
Right. And interested in the same land.
Right. And there's this famous David Lowe cartoon where they are Stalin and Hitler meet over the corpse of Poland. And mm-hmm. where they say, the scum of the earth, I presume, the bloody assassin of the workers. Right. Yeah, it's a great cartoon. It's one of the most famous cartoons ever. And for good reason. It turns out that these polar opposites in terms of ideology can agree to divide up Eastern Europe, including Poland.
Right.
So Poland is basically made to disappear again. The Nazis have a free hand. They launch their blitzkrieg September 1st. The Soviets advance from the other direction on September 17th, 1939. Poland disappears in a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And the British and French are good for their word. They declare war on Hitler on September 3rd, 1939. Mm-hmm. So now we're at war. And at first, I'd say for the first 2 years, this war goes about as well as Hitler could have hoped.
39 and 40.
39, 40, and into 41.
Okay.
I think I added it up once. He and his, turns out, very superior armed force knocks off 9 countries in a row.
Holy cow.
Some of them quite small, like Luxembourg, but nevertheless, I mean, they rack up a string of victories, which are truly impressive. By the way, I don't think anyone expected Poland to survive.
Right.
People were surprised how quickly it took. Because remember, people are still thinking
quickly
about the
fell,
last war.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, World War I movements are very slow. You fight for years over a couple hundred yards of territory. Poland was a major power, not as major as people thought it was, but it disappears in weeks, not months or years.
Right.
During which time, by the way, the British and French did nothing to come to Poland's aid. It's another great what if.
Oh, right. Okay.
Germany, Hitler's a gambler.
Yeah.
He doesn't leave much of a force at all to protect his backside as he goes after Poland. There's very little protecting Germany's western frontier.
Oh.
Now, by the way, the British and French never intended to actually physically come to Poland's aid.
Oh, I didn't know that. Of course, it was
a bluff.
Right, right.
It was intended to deter. We extend a guarantee to Poland so that Hitler won't attack. But if he actually attacks, there's no way we're in a position to, well.
Was it geographic stretch in the first place?
Well, right. But, I mean, they didn't have to actually come to Poland's aid. They could have attacked Hitler
across
the Rhine. And,
right.
But they had no intention of doing that. Had they been interested, they could have done it.
Hmm.
But, you know, there is in the early phases of the war, the British and the French are, this is going to sound harsh, but are actually pretty feckless.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very aggressive at all. They're content to sort of sit back and wait for the attack to come. Which, by the way, Hitler originally intended to do immediately after the Polish campaign.
Oh, okay.
He intended to attack west against Britain and France in the fall of 1939.
So this period where the British and French aren't doing much, is that what they call the phony war?
That is the phony war. That's when on the Western Front, you know, there's this... When war breaks out in September 1939, there's this brief panic.
Yeah.
In London, and people start carrying around their gas masks.
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly, people settle into this routine where the war is kind of a joke, where there's no combat going on, where on, you know, the opposing forces between Germany and France, they occasionally fire a few shells at each other or propaganda leaflets, but there's no combat.
Right.
And, you know, the British and French, they're making the mistake of passivity. You just sort of sit back and let the initiative go to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out Hitler can't immediately turn west. Right? Logistically, that's a nightmare. Then the winter of 1939, 1940 turns out to be one of the harshest of the early 20th century.
Okay.
Things don't really... There's a lot of naval combat going on. There's the U-boat campaign gets started. So there is fighting. But nothing happens until the following April 1940 when Hitler turns north and invades Denmark, neutral Denmark and neutral Norway, and knocks them out pretty quickly.
Right, which of course are right on Britain's ocean or sea,
border. And it does change that because, you know, Germany's geographic problem is that they're easy to bottle up.
Right.
The British can easily blockade the North Sea, not when the Germans control Norway.
Right.
Which, of course, is very skinny, but over 1,000 miles long and stretches way up toward the North Pole, way past the Arctic Circle, and gives the Germans a lot of naval and air bases they can use to project power more easily. But in this early period, people are dazzled by German power.
Hmm.
especially the fall of France, which happens, the Germans attack west in May 1940. A lot of people at that time said, well, sure, Poland fell quickly because it's Poland.
Yeah.
But France, everyone agreed worldwide, France is a major military power.
And a huge army.
Huge army, at least as big as Germany's. A modern army, with not just modern fortifications, but modern equipment. They had better tanks than the Germans, tank for tank. People thought that this would be a repeat of World War One. They thought it would last for certainly months, probably years. And a lot of people, including the Americans, including the Soviets, were counting on this lasting a long time.
Right.
Everyone is sort of, this is going to buy us time. Mm-hmm. Right. Americans are sort of treating France as their bulletproof vest. Right. We're not
Rearm.
Prepared. We're not prepared for war, but we're good because France will, even if France loses, it'll take a long time. Well, France actually fell in 6 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not even 6 weeks. Everyone, and you know, France is, it's the size of Texas. It's a big place. It's got a huge army and they go down really quickly. And this is not really sort of Hitler. This is Hitler's generals. This is the genius of the German general staff. It is sort of an organizational and strategic masterpiece. They really do know what they're doing. They are fighting the next war. The British and the French are fighting the last war.
Oh, right, because they're entrenching in the Maginot Line and things like that.
And they're using their tanks as sort of infantry support weapons rather than massing them for breakthroughs and exploitation, the way the German Blitzkrieg does. The Germans even successfully sucker the British and French into replaying World War One, right? Because when they attack on May 10th, 1940, the British and French immediately move up into Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking it's going to be a repeat of World War One,
right.
When in fact what the Germans are doing is their main breakthrough is in the center, in the quote-unquote impenetrable Ardennes Forest, which they take 3 days to get through, and then they race to the channel and bag all those forces that have been rushed into Belgium.
Yeah, they go around, the end around sort of thing.
Right. But then things you start to see, in retrospect, certainly you start to see mistakes. One mistake covered in the last episode, which is worth repeating, is that Hitler's war is way ahead of schedule in terms of German military preparedness.
And what the German
High
military
command
want.
Wanted.
Yeah.
Right. They 1939, they would say that the buildup of the 1930s is only partially complete.
Right. And again, we get this the myth is that they built this massive, monolithic thing that's unstoppable, right. And then once they got it in motion, that's just not true.
For example, never at any point in World War II is the German army even close to mostly mechanized.
Wow.
It's all horse-drawn.
Wow.
It's almost entirely foot infantry. They have mobile units. They have panzer units. They have motorized and mechanized infantry. That helps them a lot because they use it with imagination. But it's largely a conventional foot-slogging army.
Ugh.
But partly what goes on in this period is you start to see some earlier mistakes rear their head. For example, Hitler's refusal to build a truly strategic air force.
Huh.
Germany never had a big force of heavy bombers the way the British and the Americans do. So they, when it comes time to use air power in that way, they are ill-equipped. That's one of the reasons why they lose the Battle of Britain. It's because they are using medium bombers and small bombers to do something the big bombers should be doing.
All right.
They also have very good fighter airplanes, particularly the Messerschmitt Me-109, which is a great fighter plane with extremely short range.
All right.
So one of the reasons they lose the Battle of Britain is that their planes can spend like 20, 30 minutes over Britain before they have to go back and refuel.
Wow. And that's amazing.
And these are things you don't necessarily think of. By the way, speaking of the Battle of Britain, right, France falls June 1940. Unbelievable triumph. Hitler goes and doesn't dance his jig.
Right, yeah, with the famous Hitler jig that we busted that myth a long time ago.
The jig that never happened. He was certainly triumphant, right?
He was very
careful to sort of stick the knife in, right? Forcing the French to surrender in the same railway car where that was really petty, by the way.
Yeah.
But
he's a master of the image of that sort of thing.
Exactly right. Yeah. And he returns to Berlin in July 1940 to ecstatic crowds. The Germans are so triumphant, so relieved, right? The traditional enemy has been crushed with relatively little cost.
Yeah.
By the way, just for comparison purposes, the Red Army, the Soviet Red Army, lost more men taking down Finland in 1939, 1940 than the Germans did taking down France.
Wow.
Just for comparison purposes.
Wow.
Right. And remember, everyone on both sides remembers 1914 to 18.
Yeah, yeah.
And how painful that was. Here, Hitler does it. So Hitler seems like a magician.
Yeah. And it must seem like very modern warfare tactics.
Yes,
because it's going so fast.
How did you do this? How did you, with so little losses, knock out one of the great military powers on the planet? People are sort of in awe. One of the problems is, in a way, France collapses too quickly because the Germans are not ready for the follow-up. They are not prepared then to invade Britain.
Oh, right.
Now, in a way, they were going to have to wait anyway because they had to secure control of the air.
Yeah.
Right. And remember, Britain, again, like many times in history, benefits from the fact that it's an island.
Yep.
And that has a very powerful Royal Navy. Mm-hmm. The German Navy can't take on the Royal Navy. But if you control the air, you can make the Royal Navy disappear.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They have to flee, and then you could have your cross-channel invasion. And by the way, had the Germans managed to get a foothold in Britain in, say, July, August 1940, they would have taken over Britain.
Yeah.
The British and the French did evacuate a lot of troops from Dunkirk. Those forces bagged in Belgium. This is one of Hitler's first mistakes is he did not press his advantage. We don't know why for sure, by the way. It's possible he wanted to allow the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, to have the sort of coup de grace.
All right. Kill them. Yeah.
But they gave the British and French just enough time to evacuate over 330,000 men across the channel.
Yeah, that's an enormous sum.
It's an enormous force, right? That was a huge chunk of the British army. Now, they left all their equipment in France.
Yeah.
And as Churchill pointed out at the time, you don't win wars by evacuating.
Well, no.
Which is a good Churchill quote.
It's true, first of all.
It happens to be true, and he actually said it. Yeah, you don't win by evacuating. But the Royal Army does quickly recover. By September, October 1940, they had recovered, and an invasion would have been very hard for the Germans.
Right.
It's all moot because the Germans lose the Battle of Britain. They lose the battle for control, really the first major campaign in history that's entirely conducted in the air.
Yeah.
The Germans lose that battle for lots of reasons. Partly, by the way, superior British organization.
And
efficiency.
Yeah.
Their command and control system was state of the art.
But the myth is the other way around. It's the Germans who are so efficient.
British efficiency is not something that rolls off the tongue. But in the summer of 1940, they were running circles around the Germans because of their sort of command and control. And you've probably seen, maybe the Buzzkillers have seen, some of the photos of British staff women pushing little models across those chart tables.
Yeah. There are hundreds of movies.
And radar was brand new, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
But they were able to mass their fighter planes at just the right place, just the right time, because of this command and control system they had. They hooked up the radar to these sort of control centers, and they were able to really mass where the Germans were and inflict enormous losses on the German Air Force.
Well, and believe me, in Britain, there's no lack of celebration of those techno boffins
and how much they win.
But the other myth about the Battle of Britain, certainly on the British side, is that it's because of the plucky Spitfire fighters who were just sort of morally better guys and better pilots, and they were able, one Spitfire was able to take down six Messerschmitts or whatever.
That's not true.
And that's certainly not true. It was actually superior numbers and superior tactics.
Yeah. Right, yep. Because some of the German pilots were extremely good.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Although we should also point out that a lot of the RAF pilots weren't even British.
Right. A lot of them were Polish.
Huge numbers of Poles and Czechs and South Africans and a few Americans even, by the way. In any case.
And those Polish pilots were eager to join.
Oh, yeah. Talk about motivated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even later in the war when the British and the Polish have fair numbers of ground units, Germans didn't want to run into them. As you might imagine. In any case, so the Battle of Britain, and that's partly Hitler not thinking ahead. Mm-hmm. Then he compounds his error by sort of giving up on Britain and forgetting about it.
Right.
And it's curious, but partly what's going on here, and I think this is overlooked, is that Hitler's heart Hitler's heart was never in the war against Great Britain.
That's interesting.
It's a war he didn't really want. He viewed the British as sort of junior varsity Germans.
Right, yeah.
Sort of not
Angles and Saxons.
Right, yeah. Not quite German, but you know, he's got this racial hierarchy in his head, and the British are toward the top. He admired the British Empire. Mm-hmm. I know we're fond of saying things like, oh, today Germany, tomorrow the world.
Yeah.
I have my doubts about Hitler's true interest in world conquest. He was interested in European conquest.
All right, okay.
From what I've seen, he would have been happy to split the world with the British Empire.
Yeah, I think
he's not interested in India and Australia, frankly.
Yeah.
And he sort of liked the British Empire. He was interested in knocking out Poland and France, but, you know, he quickly loses interest in Britain And you see this, look at the timetable, December 1940, he signs off on an invasion of the Soviet Union the following spring.
Yeah.
That's just, the Battle of Britain's still going on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he's making the classic strategic blunder of not defeating one enemy before turning onto the next one.
Right. And also another plan that the German generals knew that they were not ready for.
Right. Although in that case, a lot of the German generals did sort of share his cockiness.
Oh, okay. By that time, there had been enough win.
And also the thing I mentioned before, that winter war between Finland and the Soviet Union. Late 1939, early 1940, the Soviets win that in the end, but only by sort of killing a butterfly with a hammer.
Yeah.
There was no finesse at all. The Russians lost enormous casualties, and everyone noticed, including the Germans. And that's one of the reasons they thought the Soviet Union was a paper tiger.
Mm-hmm.
That was compounded by, as I think I mentioned in an earlier show, the failures of German intelligence.
Yeah, well, that show was weeks ago, so it's hard to remember.
They grossly underestimated the size of the Soviet army.
Yeah.
But remember, when you knock off nine countries in a row, when you're in effect 9-0, that can go to your head. You start
playoff
to think,
bound, yeah.
And you know, it's like the German generals no longer doubt Hitler.
Yeah.
Everything he touches, he turns to gold. We defeat all our traditional enemies in style. Why won't it happen again? The Soviet army has demonstrated the fact that it's a joke. Our army is invincible, so let's invade the Soviet Union. Clear among his many mistakes, this mistake of invading the Soviet Union, June 1941, category of its own.
Right.
This is the biggest blunder among the blunders, Germany taking on the Soviet Union. He's a gambler.
Yeah.
His attitude is, we'll knock them out of the war quickly, and if we don't, we're going to lose the war anyway.
Right. Yeah,
that's essentially his attitude. If you, I mean, because, you know, looking back, it's like, what on earth are you thinking?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How could you think this is a good idea? Leaving, you know, by the way, he can ignore Britain because at the moment, Britain is not in a position to defeat him.
Right.
But it's going to come back to haunt him, especially once the Americans get into the war.
Yeah.
But June 1941, he rolls the dice like never before, launches the largest land invasion of human history.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 million men invade the Soviet Union, Germany and its allies. There were some countries who often get forgotten who jumped on the Nazi bandwagon to their great regret.
Yeah.
Like Finland looking for payback, also Bulgaria and Hungary and Romania. This invasion goes super well at first. There's some German some German panzer divisions that advance 75 miles in a single day.
Which is lightning speed. And when it's
just my God. Yeah. That's like they're on maneuvers.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, facing
they're literally no opposition at all. The problem is the Soviet Union has 11 time zones. It's got a lot of territory to lose and still stay in the war.
Yeah.
And the Red Army has a lot of units it can sacrifice and still fight.
Oh, so it's not as if Hitler's sitting there thinking, I need to conquer all these 11 time zones.
No.
It's that the Soviet Union can keep pulling back and still be in their own country.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the German plan was never to occupy all of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
It was to occupy European Russia all the way up to the Ural Mountains and then basically police that border. And because by then all the Russians won't have any capacity to resist. It'll just be the Siberian power that we can
tolerate. That's where all the money is, and that's where the industry is. Okay.
So the German army does really, really well. Captures literally millions of Red Army soldiers, smashes entire divisions.
Millions of Red Army soldiers.
Millions. Wow. They capture, in all of World War II, almost all of them in the first year of the war, they capture almost 6 million troops. And as the German chief of the German general, the army chief of staff, Halder, says in his diary, he says, they set up, you know, we smash a dozen divisions, and then there are another dozen put in front of us.
Wow.
And I forget the exact numbers, but he says something like, when we invaded, we expected to encounter 200 divisions. We've already counted 360. So in other words, even though things are going well at first, the first few weeks of the advance, they're starting to think, uh-oh, this army that we've attacked is much bigger than the one we anticipated. And even though we are having these massive battles of encirclement, the Kiev pocket, they captured, 685,000 troops in a single encirclement. I mean, this is just, in military history, this is just epic. At the end of the day, there the Red Army is still putting men in the field. And if I can quote Churchill again.
Be careful.
Sorry.
We'll check you.
I think this is from his history of the Second World War.
Okay,
said it was like an elephant attacking an ant colony.
Yeah.
And the basically said the elephant will kill thousands, maybe millions of ants, but at the end of the day, the ants will eat the elephant to the bone.
Right.
Not a bad analogy.
No, not a bad analogy.
Thank you.
At all.
Thank you, Sir Winston.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll give him credit for that one.
But they inflict grievous losses on the Soviet Union, but they do not knock out the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And the Soviets are in a position to counterattack. And by the way, it's not just about the size of the Soviet Union. If you look geographically, if you look at the border between the Nazi Empire and the Soviet Empire in mid-1941, mm-hmm. and then as you go east, the front gets longer and longer and longer.
Yeah,
north to south, it widens a lot. So the further you go in, the longer your front line becomes if you're the Germans.
And impossible to defend the whole thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you're starting to see is what Paul Kennedy would call imperial overstretch.
Oh, right, yeah.
You are basically creating an empire that is too big for you to defend. Mm-hmm. Now, they probably would have lost the war anyway by the sole act of invading the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union just had too big a population that could be mobilized by the communist dictatorship run by Stalin.
Right. But imperial overstretch made it worse.
Much worse.
Worse for the Germans.
To the end of the war, the Germans have 500,000 men defending Norway.
Wow.
That's a lot of troops that could have done a much more useful job defending against the Americans and the British and the Russians.
Right, okay.
But there they are, protecting all this turf that at that point in the war, 44, 45, is completely useless. Yeah, so Hitler's decision to invade the Soviet Union June 1941 is a massive strategic blunder on its own.
Yeah.
It's compounded by the fact that 6 months later, he declares war on the United States, December 11th, 1941.
Now, why is this a blunder?
Well, because he's essentially taken on one of the most powerful countries on the planet and then proceeds to take on the second most powerful country on the planet.
Okay, but why wouldn't he sort of automatically declare war once the U.S. has been attacked? You know what I'm saying? For Americans, right. I think the misconception is once Pearl Harbor starts, then we're in it
with everything,
but we don't have to
be. The Germans and the Japanese and the Italians were joined in what was called the Tripartite Pact, which was signed in September 1940. That did not obligate them really to do much of anything. It certainly doesn't. It obligates you to come to each other's defense, but not to come to someone's aid when they launch an attack.
Oh, so they didn't have to declare war in the United States just because of the Japanese attack.
Absolutely not. No, in fact, it's this very awkward situation because, of course, unlike what Bluto said in Animal House, the Germans did not attack Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, there's that myth.
You know, so December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked the Americans and the Americans declare war in Japan. It's up in the air for this really awkward four-day period what happens between the Germans and the Americans. Now, context, the Germans and the Americans were already shooting at each other in the Atlantic.
Okay, yeah.
Because the Americans had passed their Lend-Lease Act. They were shoveling enormous amounts of aid to the British after March 1941. And the U.S. Navy was basically convoying this stuff halfway across the Atlantic because there's no point in passing Lend-Lease if the stuff ends up in the bottom of the Atlantic because of German U-boats.
Right, right, right.
So already in the fall of 1941, you have what's called an undeclared naval war between the Germans and the Americans. You have U-boats and U.S. Navy shooting at each other, inflicting casualties on each other. The FDR announces a shoot-on-sight order. In other words, the U.S. Navy, if you see a U-boat, fire on it. That's an act of war, not at war yet. By the way, the Americans and the Germans would have gone to war at some point anyway.
Sure, sure.
But on December 7, 1941, Roosevelt doesn't have the authority or the sort of popular support for war against Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't attack Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So Americans are fired up about the Japanese.
His declaration of December 8th is against Japan.
Japan and Japan alone.
Right.
Hitler, thank God he was an idiot, because he solves Roosevelt's problem by declaring war on the United States. Now, if you're wondering, like, why would he do this?
Yeah.
Part of his thinking is, well, first of all, we're already unofficially at war.
Yeah, yeah.
Make it official, we can take the gloves off. And for example, we can wage a U-boat warfare against the eastern seaboard of the United States, which they will do to great effect in early 1942.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is Hitler, in his strategic ignorance, assumed that the United States would have its hands full in the Pacific.
Right.
And they wouldn't be able to wage war against him in the Atlantic. Big mistake. And once again, if he knew anything about the United States and its industrial power,
right,
he should have thought otherwise. He's got people like his foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, saying things at that point, saying things like, great powers don't have war declared on them. They declare war,
mm-hmm.
which is like foreign policy brought to you by a six-year-old. So there, I mean, he sort of has his reasons, but you know, big picture, he declares war on the Soviet Union and then war on the United States within 6 months of each other.
Yeah.
He's taking on the two most powerful countries on the planet.
Yeah.
Right there. And there's nothing else he could do as a strategist that could retrieve the reputation that comes from those two acts.
Wow. Right?
Between those two, he has basically signed him, his and his country's death warrant.
Huh.
Because there's no way, I mean, the war might last a long time. It may last a short time, but you are not going to win that war.
Right.
Once American and Soviet power is fully mobilized and brought to bear, you're going to be crushed like a bug.
Right.
And that's essentially what happens.
That's happened, yeah.
I mean, Germany does go down very, very hard. They last a long time over this vastly superior sort of force arrayed against them, which, by the way, also includes not just the British, but the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget, you know,
there's
this popular image of Britain alone.
Yeah, but no.
When I lecture on this, I have this caption, Britain Alone, and I show a map of the British Empire. Yeah.
It's like Canada, Australia,
New Zealand, South Africa, India, lots of places, lots of manpower, lots of resources.
And also a lot of them in very, very strategic places.
Absolutely true. And a lot of quote-unquote British manpower in World War II on the ground is actually Commonwealth manpower.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah.
Including in North Africa, where I forget how many flags are under Montgomery's command. It's a bunch. Anyway, so... we're just getting started with his strategic blunders. It includes, for example, his insistence on absolutely brutal and rapacious occupation policies.
Yeah.
Where, for example, in the Soviet Union, a multi-ethnic state where a lot of minority populations were under Stalin's heel. And, you know, the Ukrainians welcomed the German soldiers as liberators.
Wow.
Had the Nazis had even a marginally humane occupation policy, they could have tapped into some of that sort of sentiment and recruited to their cause, which they do in a very half-hearted way when it's too late down the road.
But they go in with this Jewish Bolshevik, you know, hate, and they just think they've written everybody off.
Thank you for mentioning that, because by design and before the Nazi invasion, Operation Barbarossa, begins June 1941.
Yeah.
By the way, just parenthetically, Barbarossa was the German king from the Middle Ages.
Yeah, Frederick Barbarossa. Yeah.
Barbarossa, who led one of the Crusades and died crossing a river. Like fell off his horse, and apparently his suit of armor helped drown him. Bad name for this operation.
Exactly.
By the way.
Yeah.
Not a really good omen. Anyway, where was it? Anyway, had they done even a little bit to tap into some of this sort of anti-Soviet resentment, had they tried to mobilize European popular opinion rather than just completely crushing and tyrannizing all the people under them, they could have lasted a lot longer.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's completely left out of
the standard. But they are, especially in the East, I was going to say, already in March 1941, Hitler is meeting with his generals.
Yeah.
And he's saying this war in the East is not going to be like the war in the West. This is going to be a Vernichtungskrieg. This is going to be a war of annihilation.
Right.
And you see it I just saw the stats. About 60% of Soviet prisoners of war die in Nazi captivity.
Oh.
It's almost 2/3. British and American and French POWs in the West taken by the Germans.
Mm.
They're not treated very well, by the way. But their death rate is something like 3%, 4%, or 5%.
Yeah,
that's an entire world
of difference.
World of difference. The Germans have some minimal regard for British and French and American troops that they capture. Absolutely no regard for Soviet prisoners of war, who they either line up and shoot or kill by starvation, disease, and overwork by the millions. In any case, that's a huge strategic blunder. In other words, a refusal to take advantage of some of the sort of anti-Soviet sentiment that you could make work for you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, by the way, there are all sorts of non-Germans who serve in the German armed forces. The SS recruited, quote-unquote, ethnically pure people from the Nordic countries.
Right, who were they thought of as Aryan or Aryan in a way. Right?
You know, there were sort of Belgian SS and Dutch SS forces fought and died in the Soviet Union. Also overlooked, Hitler refuses to put the German economy on a full war footing until 1942.
Wow. That's already 3 years into the war, or 2.5 years into the war anyway.
And so he does it then, and that helps explain why Germany does such a an amazing job of lasting as long as it did, like in terms of like aircraft and munitions production.
Okay.
Right? Once
okay.
they put Albert Speer, who was a genius, put him in charge of German production. Had they done that earlier, the war would have lasted a lot longer. He doesn't do it. And the answer for this is once again, World War I.
Right.
He, if anything, exaggerated the importance of the fact that German support for the war effort in World War I collapsed because of privation on the home front.
Hmm.
People starving to death or not war. People being malnourished, people waiting in bread lines. He, in other words, he didn't want to rob the German people of too much butter in order to pay for the guns.
Right.
And so that's why they're continuing to produce passenger cars until 1942.
Yeah, which by the way, totally unnecessary.
The United States didn't do at all in World War II. You could not buy a new passenger car in the United States until 1949.
Wow. Oh, until 1949.
1949. I mean, I think they still had some old models around.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
New cars, I mean, they just put a complete stop to passenger car production.
Well, I bet the 49 model year was a big deal.
People a little anxious to get a new ride.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. But in other words, he is terrified that if he asks the German people to sacrifice too much, that he'll lose their support for the war effort.
Right.
And he takes that so far that it costs the German war effort.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of production.
And in a way, that's a kind of stab in the back that he's railing against 20 years before.
Exactly, right? I mean, you know, it's funny. The British and the French always get the rap for refighting the last war.
Yeah.
He's sort of refighting the last war, too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that going around.
And making the mistakes that he was blaming the German government for back in 1915.
Exactly right. He makes other errors. Like, for example, if you look at the North African campaign, where the Germans under Rommel did very, very well for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
That is a campaign which he might have decisively changed in his favor had he, A, taken care of the island of Malta.
Right.
Which was a British possession in the middle of the Mediterranean, which got really got in the way of Axis logistics, right? Because you have to resupply your North African troops across the Mediterranean. That could have been done with relatively little effort early on.
Later, and with Italian help.
With Italian help, right? Which, of course, is a German ally. More importantly, he does not give Rommel anywhere close to the sort of resources that he could have and should have given him. Remember, they invade the Soviet Union with dozens, if not hundreds of divisions, over 100 divisions. A couple of divisions diverted to North Africa could have led to Rommel taking the Suez Canal and Cairo.
Which would have cut British supply lines and all sorts of other things.
It really would have ruined the British day in the Eastern Mediterranean. Yeah. That is for sure. But that's partly a function of overstretch, right? He's got too many pots on the stove. He's trying to juggle to keep too many balls in the air. If I can mix metaphors, but that's a case where a little bit of effort, and by the way, that's an accidental campaign anyway. The German, Rommel is sent to North Africa to bail out the Italians who need bailing out like two or three times. The declaration war against the Soviet, against the Americans. And then after that, the big problem is probably just his constant meddling.
Right.
In sort of not just strategy, but in operations.
Huh, you mean kind of micromanagement?
Micromanagement, where, for example, the Russian campaign sort of bogs down at the end of 1941, and it's the Napoleon thing again, right? You run into the Russian winter. The Russians have enough strength, including some Siberian troops, which it's all tied together, by the way.
Yeah.
Once the Japanese prove that they're not attacking the Soviet Union, but are rather attacking the Americans and the British, that frees Stalin to send Siberian troops, some of them very good at winter fighting, by the way. Who knew?
Yeah.
sends them west to fight against the Germans and save, helps them win the Battle of Moscow, helps them with a counterattack at roughly around the time of Pearl Harbor, early December 1941.
All right.
And at that point, Hitler sacks the head of the OKW, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, that's the German armed forces, and takes the position himself. So it's
micromanaging.
It's as if we were at war and the President of the United States said, I don't like what the Pentagon is doing in this war, and I'm Commander in Chief, so I'm going to move my office to the Pentagon.
Wow.
And take over day-to-day management of the military. That's December 1941. That's pretty early in the game. He is already sort of assuming that he can be the best general.
Yeah. And this sort of aggrandizement and myth-making in his own head now. He's believing his own propaganda. He's believing his own image making.
That's it. And it's partly also the way the war on the Eastern Front unfolds at that very moment, because the Russians counterattack.
Yeah.
The German forces, it's not, by the way, it's easy to exaggerate the role of the winter. It was cold for all the soldiers on both sides, by the way.
Yeah. That's often the...
Much more important is the fact that the Germans were overextended. They had outrun their supply lines. They were spread too thin. They had, just through sort of attrition, a lot of their equipment needed to be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians counterattack in great force, and the generals basically say to Hitler, look, we have to pull back or we're done.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler says, nonsense. They will hold their ground and we'll ride this out and we'll prevail.
Wow.
Turns out in that instance, he was right. German Wehrmacht in defense turns out extremely resilient. The Russian counterattack was mishandled in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
suffer huge losses. And the important thing for our purposes is that Hitler can, after this, say, look, I said they could hold their ground. The generals said they couldn't. I was right.
Oh, I see. He's able to use that.
So then in Hitler's head, he's like, you know, my generals, the guys who went to the war college and have all this ribbon and all these silver epaulets, they don't know what they're doing. I'm not just a master politician. I'm a master strategist. So I'm going to feel free in the future. When they say the sky is falling, I know it's not true. And I'm going to start swapping generals and field marshals in and out whenever I please, whenever they sort of get in my face or I think they've been disobedient.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not just going to determine strategy. I'm going to, you know, look what happens in the summer of 1942 when he goes after Stalingrad. He sort of resumes his offensive. He moves his headquarters to Ukraine, hundreds of miles into the Soviet-occupied territory, so he can more directly manage the campaign. At the same time, we're through a lot of fits and starts. His counterpart, Joseph Stalin, is gradually learning how to back off and be a manager. Hire good people and let them do their jobs. Mm-hmm. Hitler never understands that. He micromanages. Later in the war, when the war starts to go against him, he issues endless sort of stand fast orders, including to Rommel, by the way. I forbid retreat.
Yeah.
We'll fight to the last man and through superior will. And remember, he's all about will.
Absolutely.
Through superior will, we will prevail.
Huh.
And it, from everything I've read, it shortens the war a lot.
Wow.
Because German units, especially when things start to go south a lot, like in the summer of 1944.
Yeah.
When you basically have the destruction of Army Group Center in Russia, the most important World War II campaign people have never heard of. When it's worse than Stalingrad.
Everyone's heard of Stalingrad. They haven't heard about the destruction.
Everyone's heard of Stalingrad in terms of German losses and how much territory the Soviets regain.
Yeah.
It's an absolute disaster, partly because the Soviets managed to fake the Germans out, but also because of these stand fast orders. Hitler's basically like, we'll make these called Schwerpunkte, sort of strong points.
Yeah.
We'll defend a city and let the Soviet forces go around us and cut us off, but we'll hold out until the counterattack.
Wow.
Which never comes. And this is when the Soviets start to bag significant numbers of German POWs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of whom are famously marched, this is summer 1944, some of whom are famously marched through the streets of Moscow. And it's basically a parade of humiliated, captured German soldiers, and Soviet citizens are invited to show up and scream and spit at them. And following close behind them are street sweepers.
Oh.
Just sort of we just had all these German troops march past Red Square. We need to clean the streets afterwards. And of course, a lot of those Germans are not going to survive. In fact, most of them are not going to survive Soviet captivity. But what you see as the war goes on is, once again, imperial overstretch. The Germans are trying to defend basically all points of the compass. They're fighting in Italy. They're fighting in the Soviet Union. After June 1944, they're fighting against the Western allies in France. They still have to protect Norway.
Yeah.
And they just don't have the troops. And they start to, by late 1944, they've got the so-called Volkssturm. They're,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people with thick eyeglasses and old men and wounded people teenagers are being sent to the front. And so it's pretty pathetic.
Is this the point at which the sort of mythology of Hitler's brilliance and mythology of Hitler's strategic genius starts to fall away and there becomes domestic internal opposition to him that actually matters?
Yes, and that's a really important point, especially because the really only effective opposition to him internally is focused in the army.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprisingly, those are the people who have sort of the organization and the weapons.
Right.
Because, you know, it is a police state in a lot of ways. Very, they, you know, it's hard to be an opponent of Hitler. I'm not going to minimize that. But, and it's important to point out that a lot of these generals were pretty happy to go along with Hitler as long as Hitler was winning.
Right.
And then they start to see that the Germany is losing, and they recognize this before Hitler is willing to admit it.
Yep.
And they worry that if the war continues, that Germany will be not just defeated, but annihilated.
Yeah.
Because remember, the ally, the West, all the allies have agreed on unconditional surrender.
Yep.
That's their official policy. And so you start to see this opposition growing to Hitler within the Wehrmacht. By the way, as I was surprised how good it was, even though it has Tom Cruise in it. And that is the movie Valkyrie.
I think Tom Cruise is actually a buzzkiller. So we got to be careful.
What? Okay, yeah, we can edit that part out.
Yeah,
can't
we'll edit that part out.
Mr. Cruise, I'm so sorry.
Keep downloading.
Please tell all of your friends. In any case, a surprisingly good movie, which sort of captures some of the sort of ins and outs of this famous plot. They tried to kill Hitler several times. He was a very difficult target.
Yeah.
Unlike Reinhard Heydrich, who gets assassinated in this movie, Anthropoid, who was an easy target. Same route to work every day, leaves his motorcade. I mean, really was asking to be assassinated. Yeah. Hitler, much more unpredictable, hard to kill. And these people were basically unlucky, right? They do manage to plant a bomb in his headquarters in East Prussia.
Yeah.
Hitler, turns out, is only survives because of the oak support of the conference table that he was leaning over.
It's powerful enough to withstand enough of the blast.
By the way, originally, the usual room they had a conference in was a concrete bunker.
All right.
Which, that would have killed everyone in the room.
Sure.
I think that show, maybe it wasn't Mythbusters. There was some documentary where they actually did experiments.
Oh.
And that bomb going off inside a cement room with tiny windows would have killed everybody inside, including Hitler. Oak support or none.
Yeah.
Temporarily, conference was moved to a regular sort of wood and, you know,
plaster
building. I think it was a temporary structure, actually, which did not contain the blast.
Oh, so it blew it. The energy blew outwards.
Yes, okay. Right. So the force of the blast is dissipated by the fact that the walls are not containing the blast. That, and, you know, so Hitler, his eardrums are broken. He gets all sorts of wood splinters.
Yeah.
He gets some superficial wounds. He's certainly traumatized by it, but he is pretty much there were people killed, by the way.
Yeah.
But he survives. He ferociously goes after the plotters.
Oh, sure.
I mean, the Nazi retaliation after the July 20th, 44 bomb plot is amazing. I've actually been to Plötzensee prison in Berlin, mm-hmm. where they executed some of the leading conspirators. And they were hanged, but they really weren't hanged. Hanging normally, not to go too deep into execution trivia, but normally hanging, you would drop a platform and then the fall breaks their neck and it's over if it works properly. These people they basically created figure eights of piano wire and put one loop on a hook and one loop around the person's head and just strangle them to death.
Oh, which is slower and more painful.
Oh, my God. Horrible death. And which, by the way, the first of these were filmed for Hitler's enjoyment.
Oh, great.
Yeah. That site, by the way, has been preserved in Berlin. You can visit that today. It's rather shocking. In any case, up to 5,000 people were killed in retribution for this.
5,000?
5,000. If there was a hint, if there was a rumor that you were even tangentially involved in this.
Yeah. If you were the mailman or one of the plotters.
Or if you were the family of one of the plotters.
Ugh.
They went after you hard. They went after people like Rommel.
Mm-hmm.
You may talk about him later, but he was implicated. And they had a real problem in that case because he was a war hero.
Yeah, sure.
So they actually gave him the choice of committing suicide. And they told him, if you don't commit suicide, we're going to kill you and your family.
Yeah.
And so he obviously committed suicide. Anyway. And after that, the relationship between Hitler and his generals is, shall we say, a little strained.
Yeah.
For example, all generals removed of their sidearms during conferences.
Oh, no kidding.
Huge SS presence. Yeah. I mean, they are super, super paranoid. And once again, it's another reason for him not to trust his military and for him to trust his own gut when it comes to managing strategy and making decisions.
Which then leads to other mistakes near the end, in 44, mistakes. 45.
Yeah, no, by late 44, it's only a matter of time. There's no way Nazi Germany survives. By this point, if you're wondering, like, why do they continue to fight? People like Hitler and his entourage, they're hanging their hopes on the Allies falling apart.
Right.
Because the big three, the so-called Grand Alliance, was an extremely strained alliance.
Sure.
right? Sure. Let's remind the British and the French, sorry, the British and the Americans don't trust the Russians for good reasons. After all, the Russians made World War II possible with the Nazi-Soviet pact.
Absolutely.
They were the bad guys. They supplied Hitler and allowed him to escape the effects of the British naval blockade between 39 and 41.
Yeah.
Solving Hitler's sort of World War I problem.
Yeah.
They were part of the problem before they were part of the solution.
Right.
And it's a really tense relationship, and Hitler's banking on it falling apart.
Yeah.
It doesn't. They are pretty staunchly unified in their desire to crush him.
Mm-hmm.
But that, if you're wondering, like he knows he's losing, why is he continuing to fight on? In terms of on the ground, by late 44, German propaganda has gone into full swing. Basically, you Germans need to fight tooth and nail because you don't want the Russians coming.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of substance to that.
Yeah.
Right? Because the Russians, they want payback. They want payback for all the devastation inflicted on their country by the Nazis, the millions of deaths, right? And so the Red Army is basically given carte blanche to act in the most bestial ways. They start raping German women systematically. In fact, they punish Red Army officers who are against rape. People like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He's sent to the gulag because he objects to the mass rape that's going on under his command. And that Goebbels has a field day with that. It's like, you Germans, even if you don't support the war effort, you certainly want to, you know, protect your daughters, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's played up. And so Germans fight tooth and nail. On the Eastern Front, it's compounded by the fact that neither side is taking prisoners.
Yep.
You fight. That's the problem with not obeying the rules of war, right? If you think you're going to be killed if you're taken prisoner, you fight to the death.
Yeah, sure. Right? Because you have a chance in that way, in theory. Right. Yeah, right.
Right. And so you fight until you're out of ammunition, and then you never surrender. The war on the Eastern Front is very, very different from the war on the Western Front.
Right, right, right.
Maybe we can talk about that some of
I'm just now thinking there's another episode in this.
Maybe.
Absolutely.
Maybe.
But what's happening to Hitler himself while all this is going on? Because now it's 45, and I don't want to pretend that we're going to go onto the set of the famous movie Downfall, but there are all these stories that he's declining health, he's losing his mind, blah, blah, blah. Are these all myths as well?
Yeah, I don't know about losing his mind. And part of the problem is we quickly fall into the realm of psychohistory.
Which
you can make a legitimate case that that's an illegitimate field because psychologists will tell you that if you don't have the person on the couch in front of you, you can't unlock their psyche.
Yeah.
Doing it retrospectively just doesn't work. By the way, no evidence, no reason to believe that Hitler was clinically insane or clinically paranoid schizophrenic or anything.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't rule that out. We certainly can't rule out personality disorders.
Yeah, sure.
Sort of clinical. We can't rule that out, but we can't rule them in either. We just don't know enough.
Yeah.
Right? You can't just look at the person's behavior and say, oh, look, they're crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Wow, that's troubling in so many ways.
He certainly changes once the war starts to go south.
Yep.
In fact, already late 1941, certainly late 1942, the war is going badly enough, for example, that he basically stops appearing in public. And of course, that's the big deal, right? Because he has this huge public persona.
In
the 30s, he's a huge public presence. People just stop hearing him. He doesn't even make radio addresses.
Wow.
Doesn't show up in public, becomes increasingly reclusive.
Huh. That early in the war? I mean, it's not early, but it's...
Yeah, already 42, 43.
I would have thought that stuff was 44, 45.
I mean, it's much worse then, but, you know, and like, for example, after the July 20th bomb plot, he goes on the radio basically just to assure everyone that he's alive.
Yeah.
They hear his voice. But he makes very few public statements and almost no public appearances. His health definitely starts to decline.
Okay.
It's hard to completely understand it because we have imperfect information. He, by all accounts, he was a hypochondriac.
Sure.
He had these sort of vague stomach troubles for a long, long time that got worse.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help that late in the war, he's under the care of Dr. Theodor Morell, who's a quack, who is basically, I think somewhere online you can find a list of some of the stuff Hitler was taking on a regular basis. It included these sort of mysterious injections, which included things like methamphetamine. And
wow.
I.e. speed.
Yeah.
And by the way, speed, if you take enough of it, you develop a tolerance and you have to have more of it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it
yeah.
can that's alter your mood and your behavior.
People are speed freaks, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a recipe for success. you know, he's certainly rattled by the bomb plot. It's possible. By the way, we know for a fact that in the last year, certainly the last 6 months of his life, he has an uncontrollable tremor in his left hand.
Yeah.
Which apparently you can even see on some newsreel footage.
Oh, no kidding, yeah.
There's this famous, at the very end of the war, where he emerges from the bunker, the capital B bunker,
yeah,
and sort of congratulates and issues medals to these very young fighters. And he looks like crap. I mean, it's quite clear okay. that he is sort of a broken man. He's grayed a lot. He's sort of aged prematurely. He's mm-hmm. only, what, 56 years old, I think. He looks 65 mm-hmm. at least. He may have had Parkinson's. We don't right. know. That might have been, I'm just speculating.
It's impossible to know because all these other things could have caused a tremor as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It could be psychosomatic for all I know.
Yeah.
But, you know.
We'll try to put these, if these things are available on YouTube, we'll try to put them on the website.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the stuff is on YouTube. Everyone who meets him is horrified by his appearance.
Yeah.
He's got this sallow look. He shuffles when he walks. He's stooped. You know, and he was never this sort of, what is this old Nazi joke, or not an anti-Nazi joke about so-and-so is the perfect Aryan Superman, blonde like Hitler, tall like Goebbels, and trim like Goering. Which is pretty hilarious because
they're all the opposite.
Right. They talk a good game about the Aryan Superman, but you know, Heinrich Himmler was not an impressive physical specimen, and Hitler wasn't either. But he was relatively trim and vigorous
yeah, sure.
in the
yeah,
1930s.
Yeah,
yeah. By the end of World War II, I mean, it's telling. And I always love like all these tabloid things like decades after World War II, Hitler is still alive, you know, yeah, hanging with Elvis or whatever. There's no way
yeah.
that he would have lived a long life because his health was horrible and the drug use didn't help. But you know, and it's the war is going badly and
yeah,
and
oh, sure.
Right. I mean, that's
it would kill a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
By the very end, you know, the last time he visits, his sort of Alpine retreat.
Yeah.
Up in the Bavarian Alps is July, 1944.
So last time. Oh, okay. So that's
last
a long,
time he's there.
Yeah.
After that, he's only in Berlin. He moves west temporarily to take charge of the Battle of the Bulge Offensive, the Ardennes Offensive, December 1944. Mm-hmm. But by, I believe, January 1945, he is in the bunker.
Wow. The bunker.
The bunker, which is way underground under thousands of tons of steel-reinforced concrete that was built actually years earlier. He's living his subterranean existence, and you know, you mentioned the movie Downfall.
Yeah, yeah, lots of very famous scenes.
It's been criticized. A lot of people think it goes too far in sort of humanizing Hitler and the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Legit, I guess. It does a pretty good job of capturing the atmosphere. We talked about
right.
this earlier about what it was like in the bunker. Based very closely on this book by Joachim Fest, mm-hmm. which I think is actually called The Bunker. It's surreal and it's pathetic. He's in these sort of dank conference rooms, no mm. windows, obviously. He's below ground. He's poring over maps with his colored pencils, moving divisions around that don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And it's surreal.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Russians are closing in on him and at great cost take Berlin. And he commits suicide, long story short, because he doesn't want to fall into Soviet hands.
So, and in a way, that's sort of a myth or misconception or misunderstanding or an overemphasis on the idea that Hitler is vigorously in charge and doing fine until he panics and freaks out about the Soviet advance on Berlin and kills himself.
Right.
But in reality, there's this long decline of over a year.
Well over a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and after they failed to repulse the D-Day invasion, June 1944... Mm-hmm. Okay, now this is your nightmare. You now face a genuine two-front war.
Yeah.
Two oncoming armies that you can't stop.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do, right? You know, and he puts his hopes behind the so-called the wonder weapons, right? The V1 and the V2 rockets.
Right.
Maybe the Allies are going to fall apart. There's this pathetic moment in the bunker, April 12th, 1945, when they get news that Roosevelt has died.
Mm-hmm.
And Goebbels is ecstatic. He's skipping around the bunker and drawing the parallel with the 1760s when maybe Elizabeth, the Empress of Russia, dies in the middle of the Seven Years' War, and it saves Frederick the Great.
And, yeah, did they think that the U.S. was going to pull out of the war to go back for the funeral?
Well, now we have a new president who now all of a sudden regrets World War II.
Yeah. And
pretty amazing. But so they are literally clutching at straws.
Wow.
Waiting for a miracle. Hitler is, by the way, they immediately create this myth that sort of Hitler went down fighting. You know, the news bulletins.
The Germans said, yes, absolutely.
The German propaganda machine sort of suggests that he dies defending the German people. Mm-hmm. He dies in the safety of his bunker, putting a bullet in his temple.
Yeah.
Not in his mouth, by the way.
All right.
It's a mini myth. He did not shoot himself in the mouth. Yeah. He shot himself in the temple. Right. I forget if they both popped poison first.
I thought they both passed sleeping pills first.
It was cyanide. He may have popped a cyanide capsule and then shot himself. They tried the cyanide out on his dog first, by the way. Goebbels decides neither he nor his family should survive Adolf Hitler. So they actually poison their six kids in the bunker and then kill themselves.
That's another thing people don't realize, how deep the sickness has gone.
Yeah, especially Goebbels' wife, Magda, she's like, what's the purpose of living in a world that doesn't have Adolf Hitler in it? I don't want to survive that. Hitler is terrified that he's going to be put on trial in the Soviet Union, like as a Stalinist show trial run by Jews. And by the way, if you look at his quote unquote last will and testament, that's one thing he's consistent about. He blames not only World War I, but World War II on the Jews.
Yeah.
He urges the German people after he's dead to continue to fight against this world scourge, the Jews. Mm-hmm. 100% consistent in his beliefs and sort of myth-making about the Jewish conspiracy and the Jewish Bolshevik threat.
Wow.
And so, he commits suicide April 30th, 1945. The Third Reich survives him by about a week.
Yeah.
You know, then he does have a successor. Actually, Admiral Dönitz of the Navy is the Führer for a week.
Yeah.
He wins a lottery for take your kid to bunker day.
Right.
Or whatever. I guess that's the good news that finally Germany is, and it's crushed. And this was deliberate. The whole unconditional surrender thing, the Allies want to avoid a repeat of World War I where Germans like Hitler can claim, we didn't really lose.
Yeah.
Germany really lost in May 1945.
Yeah. Yeah.
Germany was ravaged like few countries have been ravaged.
Unfortunately, what happens though after the war, particularly in the late 50s and 60s, is there's a crop of whole new myths about not only Hitler still being alive, which are a joke, but all sorts of other things surviving, about whether there was a good German army, the Wehrmacht was cleaner than the SS, and all these kind of stuff that kept going through in times when I was going to elementary school, kept reading these things on and on and on. There are almost as many Hitler myths post-war as there are, from
during the war. And also including the German public. Because the people who survive Hitler in Germany get to work very quickly, sort of washing their hands of their complicity in the whole enterprise.
So we've got possible more episode topics just in this.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. History marches on, and this march on, even though Hitler...
In lockstep.
even though Hitler himself was in the bunker with a bullet in his head. Talk to you next week.
Bye.